just to give a little bit of a break from the heaviness, I have a little story here from a friend of mine from way back. This is about a man in Florida in his 80s who calls his son in New York on one November day, and the father says to the son, "I hate to tell you, but we've got some troubles here in the house. Your mother and I can't stand each other anymore, and we're getting a divorce. I've had it. I want to live out the rest of my years in peace. I'm telling you now, so you and your sister shouldn't go into shock later when I move out." He hangs up, and the son immediately calls his sister in the Hamptons and tells her the news. The sister says, "I'll handle this." She calls Florida and says to her father, "Don't do anything till we get there. We'll be there Wednesday night." The father agrees, "All right." He hangs up the phone and hollers to his wife, "Okay, they're coming for Thanksgiving. Now what are we going to tell them for Christmas?" Communication is very, very important, obviously. Excuse me, we are a world of communicators. This morning's reading from the Gospel is a continuation of chapter 12, but I want to remind you that it goes back to a previous chapter where Jesus instructs his disciples on how they are to journey going out to preach the gospel. And in that passage, he tells them and he tells us that when you go on the journey, don't take anything for yourself. Don't take a walking staff, because then you look like one of the oppressors. Don't take any purse, because then you look like the rich people. Don't take anything, but basically take yourself and your integrity. And this is a continuation of that thought, which reminds us that the attitude of Jesus about the world was that each one of us should be poor in spirit. And these are the words: "In all things, strive for the kingdom. All else will be given to you as well. Do not be afraid, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Sell your possessions and give alms. Make purses for yourself that do not wear out, an unfailing treasure in heaven, where no thief comes near and no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there also is where your heart is. Be dressed for action and have your lamps lit. Be like those who are waiting for their master to return from the wedding feast, so that when they may open the door for him as soon as he comes and knocks, and blessed are those slaves whom the master finds ready. Truly, I tell you, he will fasten his belt, have them sit down to eat, and he will come and serve them. If he comes during the middle of the night or near dawn and finds them so, blessed are they. But know this, if the owner of the house had known at what hour the thief was coming, he would not have let his house be broken into. You also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an unexpected hour." The Gospel of the Lord. I have this very ponderous sermon prepared for this morning, but I don't think my voice can handle this, so I'm going to give you the brief form and probably go completely off script to say something that I think is really important. Back in 1968, when I was leaving seminary for ordination, we had a special service, a send-off, in which one of the priests who was in the seminary teaching us reminded us of who we are supposed to be. And unlike so much of what the official church was saying at the time, he summarized very well what we had been learning in theology throughout the Vatican Council and the years to come. And he boiled it down to this. He said, all the understanding you have, and all the knowledge you may have, and all the education and degrees you may yet get, mean absolutely nothing if you cannot be the person you were created to be. And that doesn't mean that you go off and do something crazy because that's what turns you on. Because back then, remember the 60s? There was a lot of craziness going on. What it does mean is that as you have spent all these years preparing for this time, you need to spend the rest of your life trying to figure out who you are, really, and what your life means. And the meaning of life is something that has always haunted me. I told you several weeks ago that from the time my grandson was in preschool, and we picked him up every day, every time he got into the car with his papers and his drawings, I asked him, so did you discuss the meaning of life? And of course, when I first started, he kind of looked at me like, are you crazy? But I kept asking him that all the way through his education years. And now that he's in college, interestingly, he's asking me, what do you think is the meaning of life? Because he's searching. He's searching to find out what his purpose is in life. He's a brilliant kid. I'm not just saying that. The kid's brilliant. He's very, very into his studies. And for example, he's on vacation this vacation. He's away from college for the summer. He's got a job there. He works from 8 in the morning until 4:30 in the afternoon. 5:30, for the first few weeks he was home, he was struggling with a concept. And so at 6 o'clock, he'd show up at Barnes & Noble because it was a good place to read. And he'd leave there at 10 o'clock and go meet with his friends and keep up his schedule of staying up all night and killing himself, you know. After about 2 weeks of that, he came home and announced to his mother one night, I finally got it. It finally clicked. I know what they're talking about. That's the kind of kid he is. But I'm reminded, too, that in our discussions, he's very interested in religion and what religion should be, not what it is. He's one of those kids that they would call today, in terms of faith, the nuns, N-O-N-E-S. They don't have one. But they're also the ones who are trying to figure out why they don't have one. Now, he was very much turned off by the church he went to. He had some bad experiences with some of the teachers and some of the things because he would always ask questions and they weren't always ready to give him answers. And so he was very frustrated. And the pastor he had was not a very good pastor. He was asked to leave eventually, but that was his experience. But he, in his 20s, he's now 20, hard to believe, is wrestling with the meaning of his life. I've been reading some journals lately. I have one from Yale Divinity School. Of course, this is all very heady stuff. But one of the things that came across in one of the articles on pluralism had to do with this very question. It seems that in college courses across the country, college course that's offering a discussion on what is the meaning of life are overbooked. College students are craving a discussion about what does life mean. Because what they're finding is that when you've completed all the things you're supposed to do, and when you're a success at what you think is what life is supposed to be, on a material level, on an economic level, on a political level, etc., the bottom line is they're struggling to figure out what does all this mean? And some would say that you give meaning to your own life by the things you choose to do. But that is a very myopic look, because that's all about me. I don't live in a world that's all about me. In fact, we live in a world much more consciously than ever before in our history of humanity, where it's all about us. And the us has faces, and we see them every day in the news. And we hear their tragedies, and we hear the successes. And we hear about their politics, we hear about their economy. In fact, what they do economically and politically and religiously is affecting the whole world around us. And so in that world, where they are looking at themselves in this vastness and saying, well, what does life mean? How do you find something that gives meaning to your life? Interestingly, which is why I quoted Pope Francis, interestingly, they are saying what we have to find is a way to be kind to each other, the way we can support each other, a way that we can help each other heal, and a way that we can learn to live together, respecting each other's opinions, choices, lifestyles, and religious convictions. Fifty years ago, we left the seminary with the very same challenge. And in those first 10, 15 years of our priesthood, the world changed dramatically in the 60s and 70s. So much so that some say that we overthrew a lot of the conventions but had nothing to replace them substantially, which left us kind of adrift, which led to the 80s and the 90s that draw us to focus on ourselves. The world has turned. The world is once again in that same place. Only this time the stakes are much higher. Because in the balance is the existence and the health of the earth itself and all of its people, and of all of its theologies, philosophies, and politics, and everything that defines who we are as people of the earth. Now, if I can go back 2,000 years, Jesus said something, probably the most powerful thing that he ever said, in this context, when he said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit. Theirs is the kingdom of God." The poor in spirit has nothing to do with poverty. It has nothing to do with all the things of giving yourself over and sacrificing and suffering. It has none of that at all. It means that we are poor in spirit, recognizing the humble place we place in this earth. I am only one. And great though I may be, powerful though I may be, I am just one of the many. E pluribus unum, that's where it comes from. But more than that, living as a poor in spirit is a person who spends most of his or her life consciously making choices that ensure that the world we touch, that the people we spend time with, that the ones who are most broken find in us a source of hope. Not resolution, not solution, not fixing everything, not taking charge of everything, a place of hope. Because in hope, the only place in which any individual can begin to dream his or her own dreams, begin to discover his or her own self, and find the encouragement in the people around to follow through, to themselves become poor in spirit, and thus to extend life to the world around them. Pope Francis, I love his phrasing. He says, people may judge you. These are to the youth who are asking questions. People may judge you to be dreamers because you believe in a new humanity, one that rejects hatred between peoples, one that refuses to see borders as barriers, and can cherish its own traditions without being self-centered or self-minded. Don't be discouraged. With a smile and open arms, you proclaim hope, and you are a blessing for our one human family, which here you represent together so beautifully. With his gaze, Jesus never made judgments about appearances, but looked into the heart. You can help bring about another humanity without looking for acknowledgement, but seeking goodness for its own sake. Content to maintain a pure heart and to fight peacefully for honesty and justice. Don't stop at the surface of things. The joy of a heart which sees and transmits goodness without growing weary, that you have freely from God, that you must give to each other. It's the same rallying cry we heard in 1968. And here it is again. Brothers and sisters, being believers in God, we need to become ever more humble, ever more open, ever more willing to be a part of the new humanity, the one that has gotten lost, the one that is confused, the one that has few values, the ones that are self-occupied, and begin to see it is about us, the kingdom of God, a place of hope, of justice, and of mercy. It's just a thought.